Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the pantograph of Friday, April 18th, 2025. We turn first to page one, where the main story is about local history, headlined WJBC Celebrates Century on Air. Governor, band, and cake, part of the party for the iconic radio station. This story is datelined Bloomington. 100 years ago, a group of friends, including Lee Stremlau and Wayne Hummer, decided to start a radio station in LaSalle inside Hummer's furniture store. It was assigned the call sign WJBC, which Stremlau coined as Where Jazz Becomes Classic. Although it has changed locations and frequencies over the century, the folks around Bloomington Normal and McLean County are still setting their dials to the radio station that prides itself as the voice of Central Illinois. WJBC has been there at everything, for everything, through everything. Loss, destruction, weather, farming, elections, they have been through it all, said Scott Miller, host of the station's morning show and face of the radio station. And I know that because I'm told it regularly by listeners that call my show, he said. This has become more than a job. This has become my life. On Thursday, April 17th, Miller hosted a special morning program that featured the Sound of Illinois Chorus, members of the Big Red Marching Machine from Illinois State University, a custom cake from Denny's Donuts and Bakery, proclamations from the mayors within and around the Twin Cities, and a special call from Governor J.B. Pritzker declaring the day WJBC Day across the state. I doubt that has ever happened in the history of the world, Miller said before the show. Inside the studio around 9:30 a.m. Thursday, Miller donned a gold sequin jacket and stood in front of a desk covered with more than a half dozen proclamations from local and state dignitaries hosting his guests. Outside his studio, surrounded by historic photos of WJBC, guests that included the likes of Gerald Ford and Martin Luther King Jr., a massive 100-shaped cake from Denny's Donuts sat waiting to be cut. Six members of the Big Red Marching Machine stood anxiously waiting to enter the studio and play ISU's fight song. We certainly enjoy celebrating all things in the community, said Mac Wood, the band director for the Big Red Marching Machine, and we are just honored to be here and happy to play the fight song for everybody. The students, two trumpeters, one trombonist, another with a sousaphone, and one more with a mellophone, were ushered into the studio a few minutes later to perform live. After they played, Miller asked if there was another piece they would like to share, something Wood was not expecting. Someone suggested the upbeat Fireball by Pitbull, which the sextet promptly and gleefully played along with its performative dance. I always get a little nervous with the unknown, 20-year-old junior Carly Gussman said after their performance, but having this great group of people and Dr. Wood and then being welcomed with so much enthusiasm and energy, it just made it super enjoyable. Impromptu performances like that, while nerve-wracking, are invigorating, said 19-year-old sophomore Andrew Snigowski. That's always cool to see people just ready to change the plan on a dime, he said. WJBC holds a special place in the hearts of McLean County residents, Miller said. I've heard from everybody that I used to sit in the back of the car and listen to it with my grandmother, he said, recalling conversations with listeners. Well, then that little girl grew up and became a mother and then became a grandmother, and that tradition has just continued on. James McManus is one of those generational listeners. I've been listening to it since I could understand language, he said with a laugh. The radio became something his family could not live without, he said. My father, when he was old, he'd wake up at 5 a.m. He'd be sitting at the table, listening to his transistor very low and listening to WJBC, McManus said. Now 65, McManus said he finds himself repeating the ritual. You become your parents in a lot of ways, he said. But the station is not exclusively for lifelong listeners. Nathan Chitwood, a relatively recent transplant to Lincoln, tunes in every day to keep up on the happenings around the area, he said. It means a lot to be able to have up-to-the-moment information, Chitwood said. The station's style, conversational as well as informational, is a welcoming one, he said. What I enjoy most about the morning show, especially, is you get real information, but at the same time, it's light, he said. It's not heavy, like most news stations are. In 2025, when many local news outlets have faded away or been syndicated and decentralized, staying in the community is paramount to WJBC's mission, Miller said. We're not a Spotify, he said. We are here, and we are live and local, which is something that we have tried to be forever. I mean, that's our battle cry, to remain invested in this community as best we can as you roll with the punches as media changes. That dedication to staying a part of the community keeps longtime advertisers like Denny's Donuts coming back, said owner David Marquardt. You need a lot of community support, and to have a lot of community support, you need to support the community, he said. Marquardt said he fondly remembered how WJBC and Denny's Donuts would help families in the past around the holidays, and how the radio station still helps fundraise for local causes. Scott Miller did a fundraiser for a dog that was mistreated, and we helped out with that to raise funds, he said. Helping the community is just as much of the job as keeping on the airwaves, Miller said. The giving of this community, it almost brings me to tears. I have watched $70,000 be raised in the back room of the Knights of Columbus for somebody's son who's fighting cancer, he said. $60,000 to $70,000 at the Knights of Columbus in the back room is unheard of. That kind of impact, the web of connections, is a testament to a strong community, Marquardt said. We would do anything for WJBC, he said. Because the news and media landscape is ever-changing, WJBC needs to adapt as well, Miller said. We continue to remain live and local and evolve with the times. Did we have podcasts from a radio station on the air 10 years ago, 15 years ago? No, we didn't. We do now, he said. That also means advertising changes. What would have been a 30-second commercial in the past is now a digital ad, he said. This evolves beyond just the commercial you hear on the radio. But on the air, it's still the same conversation, he said. It's what's happening in McLean County, what's happening that's going to affect people's day, what's happening that's going to affect people's tomorrow. While they continue to evolve, listeners and supporters like Marquardt look forward to having a place to have local news, local sports, he said. And for his part, though, there is one superficial caveat. Maybe stop broadcasting the Cardinals, he joked. Our next front page story is headlined, Durbin Mum But Money Talking. Fundraising may hint at 2026 plans. This story is datelined Springfield. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin is not quite ready to talk about his future. He made that clear to reporters who peppered him with questions following events earlier this week in East St. Louis and Springfield, where he instead spoke about the consequences of cuts to safety net programs like Social Security and of the imposition of blanket tariffs on friends and foes alike. But sometimes in politics, money does all the talking. Durbin raised just $42,695 during the first 3 months of 2025, according to a quarterly fundraising report filed with the Federal Elections Commission earlier this week. The report is figuratively giving voice to long-standing speculation that the 80-year-old will opt to retire instead of seeking re-election in 2026. Durbin, for what it's worth, downplayed the small amount, joking with a reporter who asked if there are tea leaves to be read that, well, if you want to send me a check, I'll give you an address. And a campaign spokesperson also reiterated that Durbin, who has about $1.63 million cash on hand, remains an active fundraiser. He has been actively helping out his colleagues that are in cycle, has scheduled his annual Prairie Pack weekend in Chicago this June, is sending out digital fundraising asks on a normal schedule, and held his latest public fundraising event on March 24th in D.C., the spokesperson said. Durbin said he will make an announcement on his 2026 plans soon. He could decide to run again. As the number two Senate Democrat, he can raise campaign cash quickly. And despite some evidence that his party's base is in search of generational change, Durbin would be the heavy favorite to win both the Democratic primary and the general election. That being said, Durbin's latest fundraising numbers, to state the obvious, are not those of someone who is gearing up for re-election. At least, that is the prevailing thought, both inside the Beltway and in political circles in Illinois. Just look to 6 years ago for a comparison. Durbin raised more than $500,000 and had about $2.4 million in the bank during the same fundraising quarter before his re-election campaign in 2020, according to the FEC. Durbin ultimately raised and spent more than $10 million in that election cycle, underscoring the fact that even in a deep blue state like Illinois, where he ran unopposed in the primary and had a non-competitive general election matchup, campaigns are multi-million dollar enterprises. This is understood by the would-be candidates lining up to run for Durbin's seat should he retire. U.S. Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat of Schaumburg, raised $3.1 million last quarter, bringing his campaign war chest to an eye-popping $19.4 million. Again, money talks. Krishnamoorthy has long been pegged as a future Senate candidate with his outsized bank account, and that has only been reinforced by his frequent travel to parts of Illinois that lay far outside his suburban Chicago congressional district. U.S. Representative Robin Kelly, Democrat of Madison, also believed to be eyeing Durbin's seat, announced raising about $186,000. She has about $2 million in her campaign account. U.S. Representative Lauren Underwood, Democrat of Naperville, who recently sent out a fundraising email featuring a poll showing her leading a hypothetical Senate primary in which Durbin is not a candidate, raised about $393,000 and had about $1.11 million in the bank. And Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who told Lee Enterprises in March that she would be interested in the Senate race should Durbin retire, opened a federal political action committee called Level Up in January. Fundraising numbers for the PAC were not available. It is safe to say that as it pertains to 2026 in the world of Illinois politics, all eyes are on Durbin, and to a lesser extent, Governor J.B. Pritzker, who has yet to say whether or not he will seek a third term as the state's chief executive in 2026. Both Durbin and Pritzker declined to participate in the Cook County Democratic Party's pre-slating session earlier this week. The session was for candidates to make their pitch to committee people in the state's most populous county ahead of slating for the 2026 Democratic primary later this summer. Many are eagerly awaiting their decisions. The widespread belief in state political circles is that Pritzker, a potential Democratic candidate for president in 2028, will run for re-election in 2026. With that talk about the governor's race has largely focused on if the state's struggling Republican Party will be able to mount a viable candidate to run against Pritzker, a self-funding billionaire businessman turned politician. But on the Senate side, Durbin's advanced age and sagging fundraising continue to drive the belief that he will ultimately retire. And the shadow primary has been taking shape for months as candidates raise money, appear at political events across the state, and seek to line up support among key power brokers and constituencies in the case Durbin does not run. Just last weekend, Kelly, Krishnamoorthy, and Stratton all appeared at the Rock Island County Democrats' annual fundraising dinner. All three were strong and received a few standing ovations from the audience of 325, according to Porter McNeil, a Quad Cities-based Democratic political consultant. Durbin appeared too, but via recorded video. What is playing out now is an awkward dance as candidates gear up for what would likely be a crowded, bruising, open primary, while not stepping on Durbin's toes as he makes his decision. Again, Durbin could decide to run again and lay waste to, or at least delay, the best-laid plans of those who would like to succeed him. But his fundraising says a lot. Pick whatever cliché phrase you want. Money is the mother's milk of politics, as the late former California Assembly Speaker Jesse Unruh put it, or, more succinctly, follow the money, a phrase popularized by the 1976 film All the President's Men. Either way, money tells a story, even if no one's talking. And two central Illinois members of Congress continue to post impressive fundraising numbers. U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, Democrat of Springfield, raised more than $538,000 last quarter, bringing her campaign war chest to $2.1 million. U.S. Representative Darren LaHood, Republican of Peoria, raised more than $824,000 and has nearly $5.9 million in the bank. Budzinski has already announced her intention to seek re-election. Many Illinois Republicans would like to see LaHood give the Senate race a look if Durbin retires, but the politically astute Republican is more likely to run for re-election in his heavily Republican House seat than mount a statewide campaign in deep blue Illinois in a challenging midterm year. Meanwhile, U.S. Representative Eric Sorensen, Democrat of Moline, raised nearly $326,000 last quarter. He has about $322,000 on hand. He started the cycle with only $113,000 after spending nearly $5 million in the 2024 campaign cycle. Sorensen represents Illinois' 17th congressional district, which is the state's most competitive. However, Sorensen was not included in an initial target list released by House Republican campaign arm earlier this year, indicating that at least for now, he is off the national radar. And down in southern Illinois, U.S. Representative Mike Boast, Republican of Murfreesboro, raised about $148,000 last quarter, bringing his total cash on hand to $350,000. He won his primary in 2024 by less than 3,000 votes against former gubernatorial candidate and state senator Darren Bailey, who has not yet made his 2026 plans known. Bailey, however, did no fundraising last quarter and had just $1.18 in his federal campaign account per his filing with the FEC. His state account had just $2,805, according to the Illinois Board of Elections. Our next front page story is headlined, Unit 5 okays $10 million in bonds, money to fund capital projects before sales tax revenue arrives. This story is datelined Normal. McLean County Unit 5 will be funding about $9.5 million in capital projects over the next 12 months using general obligation school bonds, a decision that was authorized by the Board of Education Wednesday. Although the approved resolution gives the district the authority to request up to $15.45 million in bonds, the passage of the 1% school facility occupation tax earlier this month gave the district the opportunity to request a smaller amount, closer to $10 million. This really is a game changer for public school districts in our county, said Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel of the new countywide sales tax. The tax, which is estimated to generate about $16 million for Unit 5 annually, will go into effect July 1st, but the district is not expected to see its first payment until October. Unit 5 had planned to use the sales tax funding to help cover more than $50 million in capital projects over the next 5 years. However, there were some projects, such as the replacement of Chittick's Junior High roof, that required funding earlier than that. Therefore, the bonds were sought to cover these urgent capital costs. The issuances also maintains the district's commitment to dedicating one-third of the revenue raised from the sales tax to property tax abatement for at least the next 5 years. This will be done by paying down the incoming bond debt using sales tax revenue instead of property tax revenue. Unit 5 Chief Financial Officer Marty Hickman said if the sales tax referendum did not pass, the district would have requested the full $15.45 million at a roughly 3.38% interest rate. This would have generated an additional $2.3 million in interest costs. Hickman said this would have been enough to cover about 2 years of capital projects. Instead, the district is estimating a roughly 4% interest rate on its $10 million bond issuance. This would amount to about $1.8 million in interest over the life of the bonds. Hickman said 100% of the bond debt will be covered by the sales tax revenue. The sales tax will be applied to goods such as prepared foods and fuel. However, groceries and prescription medication will not be charged. In addition to facility needs and the abatement of bonds issued for facility work, sales tax revenue may also fund school safety and security, mental health professionals, and services for students and faculty facility needs. In addition to Chittix, Normal Community High School and Kingsley Junior High are also in need of roof replacements. Colleen Hoos Elementary School will require water main replacements. New heating equipment is needed at Normal Community West High School, Pepper Ridge Elementary, Fox Creeks Elementary, Grove Elementary, Parkside Elementary, and Prairieland Elementary. Track repairs are also needed at the two high schools, as well as at Chittix and Evans Junior High Schools. In other business, Weichel also gave a presentation on possible changes to the district's cell phone policy. In December, Unit 5 surveyed students in grades 6 through 12, staff, and families about the use of cell phones within schools. The survey yielded more than 7,000 responses. A committee of teachers then met in March to discuss the results. The district's current policy states students may possess and use mobile devices provided they do not cause a disruption and are not used, seen, or heard during instructional time. Exceptions can be made when the use of a device is an accommodation for a student's individualized education plan or is needed in an emergency that affects the safety of the student, staff, or other individuals. Weichel said the policy as it stands closely aligns with Senate Bill 2427, which requires districts to implement a wireless communication policy that, at minimum, prohibits a student from using a device during instructional time and incorporates guidance for secure and accessible storage of devices during instructional time. Policies must also be reviewed every 3 years. The legislation was voted out of the Senate without opposition and awaits a committee assignment in the House. Weichel said in the 2023-24 school year up to March 12th, there were 582 major incidents related to cell phones and 103 minor offenses. However, major incidents in the 2024-25 school year dropped by more than half, but minor incidents were on the rise. Thinking as a classroom teacher, it would not be uncommon for our teachers to have a conversation with a student or they submit an incident report reviewing kind of like why this is an offense, Weichel said. In both years, Weichel said lunch detention has been the most common consequence of cell phone violation. However, there has been a lot of discussion about providing better education and information to students and families. For students, this could mean having discussions about responsible usage. For families, this could mean offering sessions with parents and guardians to talk about managing their child's social media. And our last front page story is headlined, Food Bank to End Bloomington Normal Distributions. Eastern Illinois Food Bank, which has been bringing its mobile food pantry to Normal West High School each month, now plans to end distribution in the Bloomington Normal area effective this summer. EIF's food mobile will continue to serve its two routes in rural McLean County, however, as well as its monthly distributions in nearby Farmer City. Sophie Ellis, marketing and communication manager for the food bank, said in an email that the food bank is working to meet a historic need for food assistance, with pantries in its 18-county service area now serving twice as many people as they did in 2022. Ellis said they don't expect this need to go down anytime soon, especially as the cost of living and the number of families facing food insecurity continue to rise. Our Foodmobile program is reevaluated on a continuing basis to ensure that we are using our resources as effectively as possible, and a top priority for the program is to bring meals to more of our neighbors in rural and underserved areas, Ellis said of the decision to pull out of the Twin Cities. These neighbors don't have resources, including public transportation and multiple grocery stores and food pantries that our neighbors have in a town like Bloomington Normal. Ellis encourages those needing assistance to use the Food Finder on the food bank's website to locate nearby Foodmobile distributions or pantries. Dana Brown, Director of Communications and Community Relations for McLean County District Unit 5, said the Normal West food distribution serves anywhere from 90 to 150 families, but said since many individuals come for entire families, the distribution actually serves a lot more people. Brown said attendees at Normal West distributions can select the items they want and that their families will use, as opposed to going to a drive-through food pantry and receiving a box or bag full of food. Planned distributions will still be held at Normal West on May 10th and June 14th, but will end after that. Brown said Unit 5 is grateful that the food bank will continue to supply the district's school-based pantry at Brigham Early Learning Center in Bloomington, but noted this is only available for Unit 5 families. She added that the district plans to move the pantry to Kingsley Junior High School before the next school year, where it will be more centralized to the whole district. They also plan to offer additional evening or weekend hours at the new location. One of the goals in beginning the Foodmobile distribution at Normal Community West High School was to get a school market established, and we are thrilled that the Unit 5 school market is currently serving students and their families, Ellis said of the school-based pantry. Dorothy Deeney, a board member for St. Vincent de Paul Society, which operates a food pantry at 705 North Roosevelt Avenue in Bloomington, said she'd heard that the food bank would be discontinuing its distributions at Normal West, but hoped that it would change its mind. Still, she said she understands their decision. When I saw the reasons about going to the smaller communities, we're kind of in a food desert on the west side of Bloomington, but not like in these small towns, so I'm really happy they're able to do that, she said. So we will keep on doing with what we're doing. We'll keep it moving pretty well. St. Vincent's has drive-through food distributions from 9 to 11 a.m. on the second and fourth Saturdays of each month, with the exception of the fourth Saturday in May for Memorial Day weekend. The pantry is also open from 9 to 4 every Monday. Deeney said they usually serve 100 to 170 households on a Saturday, but at one time they served a total of 588 households. Those wanting to register for the St. Vincent's food distributions can go directly to the pantry on Roosevelt Avenue or call 309-829-9611. The organization requires an address and birth date for all residents in a household who are interested in food pantry assistance. They must also meet federal income guidelines, but Deeney said in her nearly 8 years serving, she believes she has only had one person who is not eligible. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, April 18th, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you next.